Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Joe Grunfist, the William A. Franke Professor of Law and Business Emeritus at Stanford Law School and Senior Faculty of the Rock Center for Corporate Governance. Joe was my inaugural guest for this podcast in 2020, and he was my one-year anniversary guest in 21. This time, I bring him back to wrap up 22 and provide an outlook as we start this year. For Joe, we have skipped the traditional personal professional background discussion, and we swapped the rapid-fire questions at the end with questions on business winners and losers of 22, best and worst corporate governance trends from last year, and biggest corporate governance trends to watch out for in 23. In this podcast, we address the state of capital markets, including public and private markets, venture capital, and the tech layoff trend. We also discussed five big topics: crypto and his take on the required regulatory framework, the SEC's proposed climate change regulation, the politicization of ESG, asset managers passing through voting power to beneficial owners, and the impact of universal proxy cards on shareholder activism. As I said in the intro for my two other episodes with Joe, I consider him one of the top legal minds in corporate governance. He is also an experienced director of public and private companies, in addition to being a former commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Joe, how are you doing? We haven't talked in a long time.
I am having my best pandemic ever. I got to tell you, of all of the pandemics that I've ever experienced, I can't remember one I've enjoyed as much as this. Really, I am crushing this pandemic.
Why, Joe? What's happening? What is it making so good?
Well, you know, in all candor, of all of the people that can complain about this pandemic, I have the least right to complain. Because it's a little bit like I'm held hostage at a 14-star Michelin restaurant. My poor, long-suffering bride, whose culinary skills were rather remarkable before the pandemic, has now reached stratospheric levels. So I now have, like, the mushroom wonton of the gods. There is the Peruvian chicken. There is the bronzino. Con osso on the bone. I mean, just remarkable. I mean,
that's your favorite, right?
No, really. It's like a 14-star restaurant. I am stunned.
Okay. Well, Joe, there's so much we can talk about. You're the first guest that has been three times in this podcast, and there's a reason for that. It's always great to talk to you about these governance issues. Let me start with
you one topic. You don't want to talk about the mushroom wonton of the gods. No, really.
Hey, we can talk about that too, you know?
Oh, no, really?
But Joe, let's go into some governance topics, because I think there's a lot to discuss here. Number one, last time we talked was 2021, at the height of the markets. And I remember we had this long discussion about the irrational or crazy situation going on in the markets. Everything was up. IPOs were up. SPACs were up. Venture capital, startup valuations, everything was up. And here we are, 2023. 22 was a really bad year. It all went south then. What's going on now? What do you predict with the markets in 23? And let's start from there.
Well, look, there's a real simple explanation as to why everything went up and why everything's going down. And it's the same phenomenon. If you look at every valuation formula, every rational valuation formula has an interest rate in the denominator. All right, let's stop and let's think about what that means. In an environment when interest rates are going down and the interest rate is in the denominator, all right, the total value is going to go up. That's the simple math. And we were in an environment where interest rates were really low and getting close to zero. And one of the things I hope they taught you in high school is that nothing good happens when you start dividing by zero. You get crazy numbers. So you just do the simplest discounted present value, options, whatever it is. You come close to dividing by zero, the ratio goes nuts. Well, what happened? Asset valuations, which are the function of that ratio, they went nuts. At one level, no surprise. Now, what happens when you take exactly the same math and you run it in reverse? The stuff that went up goes down. All right? It's not rocket science. You don't have to be SpaceX and Elon Musk to say, you know, when interest rates start going up, all of this stuff is going to come down for exactly the same reason that initially went up. So, you know, what I was telling everybody is enjoy this while you can, because if interest rates ever go up, this is all going to go into reverse and it's all going to go away. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And the numbers are quite impressive. 2021, there were 311 IPOs and about 613 SPACs. In last year, 2022, only 39 IPOs and 26 SPACs. So a huge drop. And we don't know what's going to happen this year. But as you predict, maybe with high interest rates, things are not going to get any better. What about private markets and startup valuations? There was a lot of talk about layoffs and shutdowns. In fact, there was over 150,000 employees laid off in the tech industry. Only this year, there's been about 25,000 and counting. The VC is in trouble, but you know, they raised a lot of money last year, $162 billion. And it sounds like at least there's one light coming up with AI. And I don't know, what are your thoughts on ChatGPT, but that's making all the news because of its valuation. And maybe that's the only good news in the tech market. So why don't we talk about startups, private markets, and maybe AI?
Okay. So let's unpack that multi-part question, Evan. And let's start with the employees, and then you can prompt me, all right, about which other piece you want to take up on. Clearly, these are very large layoffs. These are very big numbers, and they're extraordinarily significant for many of the employees that are affected for lots of different reasons, including, for example, many of them have options. Are the options underwater? If the options are not underwater, do they want to exercise them? Do they have the cash with which to exercise them? It's a very difficult situation. That said, a very large percentage of these employees are able to find new employment very quickly, not necessarily in the same sectors that let them off, but, for example, in many more traditional sectors where there's a tremendous demand for people with a range of software skills. These are highly employable people, and they're generally, not in every situation, but in many situations, they're able to find employment that satisfies them in a different sector, doing different things, but using the same skills. So the effects in the labor market are not as large as the numbers suggest. This is not a situation where a lot of people are losing their jobs and going to stay unemployed for years. Right? That's very different than the labor dislocation we had in the manufacturing sector, right? Where you lose your job, good luck, you're not finding another one. The situation with respect to investors, however, is really different. In many of these situations, the stock goes down, you lose your money, it's not coming back, right? Especially if you wound up investing at the top of the cycle at the rich valuations. So the irony, if you want to use that word, or differential, is that the implications of this downturn in the labor market are starkly different than they are in the capital market. And here the capital providers are going to take the much bigger hit than the employees in most, but not all situations. I don't want to overgeneralize.
Yeah, no, that certainly is one way to look at it. And we are still going through many of these shutdowns. I was just calculating about, you know, depending on the numbers, about 60 to 100 companies shut down last year. And obviously, this has to do with the ability of companies to still operate, raise money. And that's, we're still going through that process of washing out a lot of the excesses that we were seeing. And do you have any thought on this new trend that everybody's talking about on OpenAI and ChatGPT? I think that's interesting, but it does have the frothiness of maybe 21. And I just think it's an interesting side story, if anything, in the tech industry.
Well, you know, I actually think that's really one of the surprises. I think it bears extraordinary attention. I think the AI, the generative AI, and the work that it does is going to get much better very, very quickly. And I think this is going to have profound implications, good and bad, across a wide range of scenarios, for investors, for users, for the education market, for what education actually means, for the ability to propagate lies that sound like they're true, which in many ways is the most dangerous form of a lie. In fact, there's a lot of research that suggests that the most pernicious form of a lie is one that contains truth, all right? Because there's something there. Well, the rest of it, you know, the rest of it ideally may also be there. So that is, again, a factor that people need to be very attentive to, and I would also say worried about.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that caught my eye, and I don't know how much you've looked into it, but the structure of OpenAI is very interesting. It was set up as a nonprofit, and then they structured a for-profit entity, and the investment of Microsoft is in the nonprofit entity, but they created something called a capped profit company, which I'd never seen. I don't know if you are familiar with something, but what reaction do you have with that structure where they actually put that the fiduciary duty was to humanity?
Well, so number one, if there's a fiduciary duty to humanity, I wonder who has standing to sue in the event of breach, all right? Because I don't know, Evan, does that mean that you have the right? And what if somebody disagrees? Right. So that, you know, look, that's a different philosophical question. And, you know, I have it on my list of things to study, you know, this transition between not-for-profit and for-profit, back to not-for-profit and for-profit. I mean, you know, I just haven't rolled up my sleeves to look at that. But, you know, the reality is these applications are so computationally intense and expensive that running it as a not-for-profit may be a not-for-realism idea.
Right.
So if we really do want to have this kind of open AI, you need to harness the profit incentive in order to be able to manifest the technology.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Let's move into another area that I know you've looked at and have been interested in and worked on, which is the crypto market, the famous crypto industry. It went to a height of about $3 trillion. It's down to just under a trillion. And 2022, we had a crazy number of collapses, right? Terra Luna, Voyager, Celsius, FTX, BlockFi, there's been a reckoning in the industry. And so the big question for you is, do you finally expect to see some regulation in this space? Is this going to come from the SEC, from the CFTC, from the states, from Congress? Where is your current thinking in crypto regulations these days?
Well, let's back up. First, with regard to your list of disasters and train wrecks, we're not done yet.
Yeah.
There's going to be more. There's going to be more carnage. There's going to be more blood in the streets. It is a fascinating phenomenon when you have so many people running around and saying, look, I'm totally honest. All right. I'm totally transparent. Here's my code. You can read my code. I have nothing to hide. And then you turn around and you ask the same joker, great, thanks for the code. Can I see audited financials? No, I'm sorry, you can't see that. Why? Well, you know, because they're not really suited to our industry and you wouldn't understand them. Hey, trust me, I would understand your financials. Can I see your financials? No. Have a look at my code. Go away. I mean, this is, you know, look, the number of people in this industry that are happy to show me their code but refuse to show me their financials should make your head spin. And if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about this space, I don't know what does. All right? Nobody wants to get regular audited financials. How hard is that? All right. You know, can you have standard systems and controls just like other people do? Nah, that's inefficient. Yeah, but stealing money is efficient, apparently. You know, this is...
So some companies, right? I mean, I think that leads us into separating different players in the industry, some of them shirking regulatory oversight, so maybe some going outside of the United States, and others trying to follow some of the rules, like going public. And, you know, I'm thinking of Coinbase, for example. And that's creating also, there is a vacuum at some level of regulatory standards. And it puts bad players and good players in a tight spot. Obviously, we want to get the bad players out, and there's a lot of them. And I agree with you, there's still a lot to be flushed out. But there's also questions on how does the industry operate following rules that may not be in place yet?
Yeah. So what I do here is I sort of segment the problem into two parts. First, there's the anti-fraud part, and then second, there's the structural regulation part. The anti-fraud part should be much easier to solve than what we have now. And my simple suggestion is as follows. The SEC and CFTC are tied up in knots about when different forms of crypto are either securities or commodities futures contracts subject to regulation. Congress could eliminate all of those concerns by simply saying, look, SEC, you have the authority to go after any crypto asset for fraud, just for fraud, all right, whether it's a security or not, okay? So what you could do is basically weaponize the SEC to go after all fraud in crypto. And you could do the same, you know, as though the crypto were a security, even though it's not. And you could do the same for the CFTC. Now, doing that only addresses the problem of fraud. And unless people in the crypto industry say, we should have a safe harbor from fraud rules, we should be allowed to conduct fraud in the ways that other people aren't, that should be an entirely defensible proposition. Okay. And if anybody on the crypto side wants to stand up and say, hey, I think I have the right to commit fraud that I couldn't commit in the securities market, I'd love to have that conversation with them. I don't think they'd last very long. Hmm. Now, separately, there's a very set of important structural issues. Do you have to register as an exchange? Do you have to do these filings? That's totally different from my point about no lying. My anti-fraud rule simply is you can't lie. All right, whether it's about crypto or just no lying. The structural issue is much more difficult because what you want to do is not chill the development of this important new technology while at the same time having an appropriate regulatory structure. And I'm the first person to understand that the traditional way that we've regulated securities or commodities may not be suitable for this new technology. I'm very open to that conversation. I'm very open to the idea that we need a different structure. But that's a totally different question from, should we allow fraud? Fraud, no. Different structure, let's figure this out. And what I think Congress can and should do is move quickly to authorize the SEC and CFTC to go after fraud in these markets. And separately, we need more time, and it's much more complicated to go after the structural regulatory issues.
So what are the odds that Congress will move into this, in your opinion?
Oh, my proposal is far too sensible for Congress to adopt.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe with all these scandals getting so high profile, the odds are getting a little bit better. Maybe. It takes scandals.
Yeah, okay. So the odds have doubled, all right, from a quarter of 1% to a half of 1%. All right, good.
Okay.
Good.
Moving into another topic that I know you've written about and you also have strong opinions, I suppose strong opinions loosely held,
No. I am more along the lines of strong opinions firmly and eternally held.
Okay. That sounds like you. But let's talk about climate change. The SEC issued the proposed regulations, and you wrote about how we may be heading toward a climate train wreck. And that is because of the rules on greenhouse emissions and EPA and administrative regulatory issues. Where do we stand? What do you think is going to happen now with the climate change disclosures? And what are the odds that this is going to happen?
We're going to see what the final rules look like apparently in April of this year. That's when the SEC's RegFlex agenda suggests that the final rules will be adopted. And I am profoundly concerned. So first, let me position myself in this debate. It appears that I have a unique voice here because, to my knowledge, all of the people who are opposed to quantitative climate disclosures take the position that the SEC doesn't have the authority to do that. And all of the people who support the idea of the climate disclosures take the position that the SEC has the authority under its current proposal to do that. I appear to be on an island alone where I say, look, investors need these climate disclosures. We should have the climate disclosures, but I am extraordinarily skeptical that the courts as currently constituted will uphold the rules that the SEC will adopt. In other words, we're going to get the rules adopted, they're going to get stayed, they're going to get vacated, and we're going to get nothing. Mm. And I don't think that's the best result for investors. That's just wrong. And why are we going to get nothing? Well, multiple reasons. First, the Supreme Court has this doctrine, which they're really expanding, called the Major Questions Doctrine. And when the Supreme Court granted cert in this case called West Virginia versus EPA, I immediately told all my friends that this was terrible for the SEC because the EPA was going to lose, they were going to lose bigly, and all of these other fancy professors said, oh, no, Grundfest, you're totally wrong for all of these reasons. Well, I turned out to be exactly right, and oh, by the way, none of them have called to apologize. Okay. And for the same reasons that the EPA lost, whether you think it's right or wrong is beside the point. You can easily take that logic and apply it to large portions of the SEC's proposed rules, not all of them, and say the SEC's rules will go down in flames for the same reason that the EPA rules did. Further, if we need another further, there's all sorts of doctrine having to do with statutory construction, the operation of the Clean Air Act, the operation of the recent Infrastructure Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, that again can be brought to the table by opponents of the SEC regulation to gut the regulation. And the problem is with the basic approach the SEC has taken. They're taking the approach that the securities laws give the SEC the authority to require registrants to measure emissions. And that's where the courts have a high probability of just saying, no, you don't. And that's why, I have an alternative that's based on a totally different philosophy that has a far higher probability of succeeding by surviving the courts and will actually cause more intelligent, more expansive disclosure of climate effects at much, much lower cost and with a much better cost-benefit analysis. But again, for a variety of reasons, primarily political and litigation strategic, the SEC is not going to do that.
Yeah. And so we just know, because you've left everybody hanging in terms of what is your solution. What is the solution? It's the SEC working with the EPA, correct?
Thank you, Evan. I thought you would never ask. It's actually simpler than that. So here's the reality. There are so many other regulatory agencies that are going to require expansive disclosure of emissions data that the SEC doesn't have to require it itself. The EU has already adopted regulations that will basically force any company doing any material amount of business in the EU, and it's every major international, to disclose much more information than the SEC is asking for. The federal government has proposed contracting guidelines that will call for Scope 1, Scope 2, and Scope 3 data from all companies, not just publicly traded companies, with a level of detail that is beyond anything that the SEC is asking for. The UK is going to have its rules. Individual states in the United States might adopt additional rules. We have the EPA Greenhouse Gas Reporting Program. So what the SEC could do is not have its own set of rules saying you have to go out and measure, when registrants will say the SEC has no authority to require that, and say, look, wait a minute. You are already reporting to the EU. You're already reporting to the UK. You're already reporting to the EPA. You're already reporting to the federal government under the contracting guidelines. Just take the information that's already in the public domain, aggregate it up on this new form that we have, and give us a good faith estimate of your total emissions, all right, eliminating double counting, so that information is then out there rationally in the public domain. And I would also suggest that the law or the SEC create what I call a deep safe harbor, so that the SEC can sue in the event of misrepresentation. The Department of Justice can sue in the event of misrepresentation, but no private right of action, right? Because creating that kind of private right of action, number one, will cause tremendous political blowback. And number two, if the SEC and DOJ are doing their job, you're not going to need it. And you have separate enforcement from the EU and under the FAR. There are other mechanisms.
You just don't like plaintiff lawyers, Joe.
Oh, I love plaintiff's lawyers when they have good claims. All right. And by the way, the SEC is filled with plaintiff's lawyers and DOJ is filled with plaintiff's lawyers, too.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And I suppose we'll see in April where we stand. And it's going to be a big, big question. And let me put it in context, because maybe the bigger, this is all encapsulated in the E of ESG. And interestingly, since we last talked, there's been a huge pushback on ESG, right? Whereas before everybody was saying ESG is the new mantra of governance, now there's a political pushback, and a lot of states have gone against this ESG and are trying to divest from these large asset managers like BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, and others. What do you make about this whole politicization of ESG and what's happening?
I think it is simultaneously disastrous and hilarious. And you know, to me, the most interesting recent event I just heard about it this morning is apparently the state of Wyoming, in order to protect its energy industry, is thinking of banning the sale of electric vehicles in Wyoming. Okay, that you can't go green that way in Wyoming. The important thing to recognize in many ways is that what's happening with regard to state activity, where you have some states that insist that you not invest in anything that is bad for the climate, and there are other states that insist that you invest in things that are potentially difficult for the climate, is that it's all political. And what you have is perfectly rational behavior by politicians who want to get reelected. And in today's environment, where we have extremism, arguably on both sides, it's perfectly rational for politicians to play to their base. And that means for politicians in deep red jurisdictions, or politicians who rely on deep red support, to fulminate against ESG. And for politicians in deep blue states, or who rely on deep blue support, to fulminate in favor of ESG. And then what you have is businesses that operate in both categories of states being subject to entirely incompatible demands, where some people say that you must do certain things that other people say you may not.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. I mean, responding to states in different ways. Let me ask you a different question. A lot of these large asset managers, because of this pressure, have started to pass through voting power to beneficial owners as a response to the fact that they may be too powerful. And we're talking about BlackRock and Vanguard. What do you think about this approach? And do you think that it's in response to these asset managers becoming so big that they already manage about 25% of the votes of the Fortune 500? If you project it down the line, they may be managing 40%, 50% of the Fortune 500. So, you know, essentially you'll have a few people like Larry Fink and others that manage a large swath of the economy. So any thoughts on the passing through of voting to beneficial owners?
Yes, I think it's politically a very, very smart thing for many of these intermediaries to do. And the other observation, very simply, is the population of beneficial holders, the ultimate owners of these shares, is really quite heterogeneous when it comes to many of these points of view. You have many investors who are pro-green, and you have many investors who are anti-green. You've got many investors who say, I'm happy to throw a lot of my money into hydrocarbons, and you've got other investors who say, hey, keep me away from hydrocarbons. To the extent that this devolution of voting power to the ultimate beneficial holder allows each individual investor more accurately to express their point of view, it's easy to argue that it is democratic and socially beneficial in a wide variety of ways. It's also very easy to explain how it gets a lot of the institutional money managers out of the soup. It becomes easy for them to say that we're no longer exercising any discretion. Rather, we're passing the vote through to our beneficial holders. And our beneficial holders are now expressing a view that they're either for or against any particular action by the corporation.
Right. Let me ask you about shareholder activism, which is another area that has grown a lot. And there's a new rule that may impact shareholder activism in a big way, which is the universal proxy cards. Are you following this, and how much do you think it will impact shareholder activism?
My bet is that it has a meaningful effect on shareholder activism. It might take a little bit of time for the effect to manifest itself completely, but it will change the way corporations negotiate with activists. It will change boardroom dynamics, especially in corporations that are susceptible of activist pressure. And it will unsettle many traditional mechanisms within the board. It certainly, in my view, shifts power to the investor community.
Mm-hmm. Let me finish with two questions, some rapid-fire questions for you, Joe. What's sure. the best and worst corporate governance trend from 2022?
Well, I think the best trend is I think we've made significant progress in boardroom diversity in a very responsible way. There's obviously more work to be done. But if you just simply look at the change in diversity, whether you measure it along gender lines or along other metrics, it's really been quite interesting and quite meaningful. More progress on the gender line than on other lines, and it's very important to underscore that. More progress yet to come. But if you want to look at broad-based success, I think that is it. Now, worst corporate governance trends, what I would call this the political whiplash, that you've got some jurisdictions and some politicians say, don't you dare, about things that other politicians say, you know you must, which then puts corporations in a very difficult position where they're being subject to consciously and willfully incompatible demands.
And what is the biggest corporate governance trend to watch for in 2023 and going forward?
Well, you know, I think in many ways it's going to be a combination of the universal proxy and the politicization of the boardroom, in part because of these whiplash requirements, and also because of the increased number of stockholders that are going to put hot button social issues on the proxy statement. The irony, in a certain sense, being that the current SEC relaxed the ability to put social policy issues on the proxy card, thinking that that would get many more left of center ideas. But now right of center people are coming forward and saying, hey, explain your policies on abortion. All right. And that's designed to create a certain friction post-Dobbs. So you know, the SEC is going to get more than it bargained for here.
And I know it's a tough question to answer, but how do you recommend boards to respond to this politicization? You know, here in Silicon Valley, for example, some people believe that you should be mission-driven. You shouldn't have any type of political discussion within the company. And I'm thinking famously of Coinbase, the position that they had, and at some point they said, look, if you don't like this, here's an exit package. And it was very generous, and about 5% of the employees left. And a lot of VCs support that, but it's obviously not a consensus. And a lot of people would argue the other way. And, you know, I'm thinking on the other end, you have companies like Salesforce who advocate very strongly on a stakeholder position. And it's a tough question now that corporate governance is so politicized. If you are on the board, and how do you advise boards to handle this? Because it's going to get much, much more politicized.
The short answer is you can't generalize. Every corporation situation is unique. In some situations, what you have is a critical workforce where if you don't take certain positions on certain issues, you alienate a large part of your important labor force in ways that are extraordinarily harmful to the corporate mission. And that will then also wind up hurting capital value because it'll disfavor you in the hiring market, in a very competitive hiring market, a market that's still quite competitive today, all right, even with all of these layoffs and the like. So, you know, it's really important that people understand that you have to look at labor market conditions, you have to look at capital market conditions, you have to look at PR and political conditions, and you have to navigate through to a solution that's best for that company, given its unique situation. Put another way, the right answer for Exxon is not the right answer for Salesforce, and that should be obvious for everybody.
Mm. Joe, thank you very much. I want to say, by the way, if people haven't read it, there is an article that you have with Arthur Rock on the Stanford Lawyer magazine that if you're interested in venture capital, I totally recommend you reading it. It was a big joy to read about that. I thought I knew a lot about Arthur, but there's some nuggets in that article that I didn't know, and I've known him for a long time. Well, so please read that article.
So two things. Number one, happy to do another podcast with you about that. Number two, I thought you were going to ask me who the biggest winner was in 2022.
Okay, let's talk. Who's the biggest winner in 2022? I thought you were, you know, you didn't have enough time, but let's go on it.
Definitely Prince Harry.
Ah.
Prince Harry crushed me. Anybody who can monetize family trauma, all right, has got to be. I mean, the guy has made hundreds of millions of dollars off of family dysfunction. I mean, he did not invent family dysfunction. He's not even experienced the worst case of family dysfunction. Yet he is going to become the family dysfunction bazillionaire. I mean, you got to give it to Prince Harry. Prince Harry is, hey, let me show the world how dysfunction, you know, I can't make a nickel off of my family. And my family makes the royal family look like a perfectly normal bunch of people. Just have dinner one night with my people, and I guarantee you, all right, you would say, wait a minute, Prince Harry, no problems compared to Joe. No problems.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that the ghostwriter of his book was the same guy who wrote about Shoe Dog and some other book that is a very popular book. And I didn't know there was these ghostwriters that obviously very successful in what he did.
Oh, they're very good. These ghostwriters are great. You know, the way I understand that you were to just sit down and you have dinner five or six times. Just tell me stories. Just tell me about this. Tell me, you know, just give me the dirt. And then they just write it up in literate language and they give it a story arc and they're extraordinarily good. They're worth every penny that they get paid.
Okay. That was the biggest winner. So now who is the biggest loser?
Oh, that's easy. Elon Musk. And he only has himself to blame. I mean, just this Twitter thing. I mean, oh my God. I mean, if it wasn't perfectly obvious that you, of all the people in the world who should not be running Twitter, you should not be running Twitter. All right. And that there would be an interaction effect with Tesla and that all of the bad stuff that was happening at Twitter would feed back into Tesla. So, you know, you got Tesla down and Twitter's, you know, I give Twitter, you know, 43.96% chance of being in bankruptcy at this time next year. You can write that down. 43.96%. Yeah. I don't mess around. So look, it's been a bad year for Elon. It's gonna be a bad year for Elon.
Yeah. How many trials can you go through? I mean, every single big governance trial is going. Elon is involved.
UCLA apparently has a course called Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And what it does, it basically looks at Elon Musk's litigation record. And I got to tell you something, the guy is a litigation magnet. He is God's gift to law firms. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Joe, thank you so much again. I hope it's not another year until we do another one, but maybe there are some... Maybe it'll be prompted in April or something when we have some big news, either from crypto or from climate. I'm sure it's always great to talk to you about these big topics. So thanks again for doing it. And I look forward to seeing you soon.
More than a pleasure, Evan. Stay well. And as we say in California, stay dry.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.